It's time for the Podketeer Podcast.
Good morning, Christopher Robin.
Oh, good morning, Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, well, glad to meet you. Name's Tigger. T-I-double-G-R. That's spelled Tigger.
Now, isn't this a clever disguise?
It's the Podketeer Podcast with your host, Mark Tanner. Take it away, Mark.
This could be about anything. And if you're like me, you'll wait and see. For I've got curiosity.
Hello, Podketeers, and welcome to episode 16 of the Podketeer Podcast. You know, I went to the park last Wednesday. I enjoyed my time, went on one of my favorite rides, the Toy Story Mania ride there at California Adventure. And I got home, and I received some very, very sad news. And it came in this form.
He was our Edison, our Disney, our Da Vinci. Yes, Steve Jobs was the most successful businessman of our generation, but deep down, he was an artist who worked in metal and glass, plastic and pixels. And the ideas that live inside his machines completely change our definition of form and function. After surviving pancreatic cancer and a 2009 liver transplant, the 56-year-old founding father of Apple Computer and Pixar Studios died tonight. He is mourned by his wife, four children, and millions around the world who could not wait to see what he would come up with next.
Well, Steve Jobs was part of my generation. He was born the same year that I was born, a little earlier in the year, but the same year. And I grew up envying his genius and wishing that I could do the kind of things that he was able to do. And of course, very few of us are able to, otherwise people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates wouldn't be the geniuses that they are. And the Disney connection is one that I felt required some kind of tribute here on the Podketeer Podcast. Those of you that may not know, Steve Jobs bought Pixar from George Lucas early on. And you will find on quite a few of the tributes to Steve Jobs, it calls him the founder of Pixar, and that's not actually the case. George Lucas actually founded Pixar. But Steve Jobs grew it into what it became. The seed money to allow them to make Toy Story and the early test movies that they made all came from Steve Jobs. And if it wasn't for Steve Jobs, there would never have been a Pixar like we know it today. So the Disney connection is absolutely there. And also Steve Jobs, as part of the purchase, when Disney bought Pixar, it involved a large number of shares and a seat on the board of Disney. Now, the following statement was made by Disney CEO Bob Iger after learning of Steve Jobs' death. He said, and I quote, "Steve was such an original with a thoroughly creative, imaginative mind that defined an era. Despite all he accomplished, it feels like he was just getting started," Iger said in a prepared statement. "With his passing, the world has lost a rare original, and Disney has lost a member of our family, and I have lost a great friend." Now, watching the tributes on television and tonight on YouTube as I went through them, it's amazing how the giants in the industry felt some kind of that they owed something to Steve Jobs. And I think they did. Because Steve Jobs created a whole new industry. Well, Steve Jobs did not invent the MP3 player. He certainly turned it into what is just an amazing industry today. iTunes did that. If it wasn't for iTunes, the MP3 player probably would still be just a little minor thing made by RCA or, you know, some other company. That it wouldn't be nearly what it is today. I seriously doubt if it wasn't for iTunes. There were so many tributes out there on YouTube, but I found one that I really, really liked. And I want to play that for you now. I don't know who created this, but the way it's handled and the way it ends, I believe this is coming either from the Apple company itself or from some of the staff of Apple. But I'm not positive, so let me play that for you now.
Here's to the crazy ones. The misfits. The rebels. The troublemakers. The round pegs in the square holes. The ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them. Because they change things. They push the human race forward. And while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Now, I know that sounds an awful lot like Richard Dreyfuss narrating that, and I believe personally that it is, although I don't have the time to check and see if it is, but if I were to guess, I'd say that's who's doing that. And I would also say, based on what's said in it, it may be something from an earlier time. I don't think it's something that was recorded after his death. But it was edited together, and a little graphic at the end was placed there that definitely shows that it was a tribute. Now, it says, "Thank you, Mr. Chairman," which is what gives me the idea that this was probably put together by Apple. As I said, I'm not positive, but I think it's either an official Apple thing or something that was done by some of the staff at Apple. Now, the next thing I've got here is something from Forbes magazine that was put out on YouTube. And I haven't been able to come up with the name of the person. I wish the people that post the stuff on YouTube would put the names of the people that are in the clips. Because it would be nice to at least, if nothing else, give the guy credit. So, I apologize for not doing that. But this is an interesting little thing about 10 things that Steve Jobs taught us. And I'd have to say I agree with all of them. So I'm going to play that for you now.
Few people in this world will revolutionize one industry. Steve Jobs revolutionized several: computing, telecommunications, music, and movies. Since he had such a profound impact on the world, I think it's fair to ask ourselves, how did he do it? And more importantly, how can we learn to unleash our inner Steve Jobs, to advance our business, our careers, and the world? In my research as an author, I've identified 7 principles that drove Steve Jobs and Apple's success. Principle number 1, do what you love. Steve Jobs taught us that you cannot come up with new, innovative, and exciting products unless you're inspired yourself and passionate about moving society forward. Steve Jobs once said, "People with passion can change the world for the better." Life is too short, he said, for living someone else's dream. And if you haven't found your passion, he said, keep looking, don't settle. Principle 2, put a dent in the universe. Steve Jobs believed in the power of vision, and he certainly had a big vision. In the mid-1970s, when computers were relegated to a small group of hobbyists, Steve Jobs was convinced that he could put a computer in the hands of everyday people. And so he challenged his co-founder, Steve Wozniak, and the Apple team to create a computer that everyday people would feel comfortable using. Eventually, that led to the computer that changed everything, the Macintosh. In 1984, the Mac helped Apple get closer to the vision that Steve Jobs had first articulated nearly 10 years earlier. Principle 3, connect things to spark your creativity. Steve Jobs once said that creativity is just connecting things. He meant that people with a broad set of experiences can often see things that others miss. Jobs often connected ideas from completely different fields. For example, he studied calligraphy in college. Calligraphy had no practical application to his life, but he was interested in it. He was passionate about it. Later, his calligraphy experience would find its way into the Mac, the first computer with beautiful fonts and typeface. Creativity is connecting things from different fields. Principle 4, say no to 1,000 things. Steve Jobs was proud, of course, of what Apple did. But he was also proud of what Apple chose not to do. Steve Jobs once said that innovation comes from saying no to 1,000 things. I believe this speaks to simplicity. You see, in Apple's world, simplicity is the elimination of clutter. So anything that clutters the user experience is eliminated. That's why there's only one button on the front of an iPad, or why there's no built-in keyboard on an iPhone. Apple's products are popular because they're simple, they're elegant, they're easy to use. But it all started from Steve Jobs asking that one question: what can we remove? Principle 5, create insanely different experiences. Steve Jobs created many product innovations, of course, but he also innovated around the customer service experience. And I think that's a big part of his legacy. Might not be fully appreciated. The Apple stores make more money per square foot than most any other retailer, including many luxury brands. And they're packed morning to night. The average store sees 17,000 visitors every week. When Steve Jobs first came up with the concept for the Apple stores, he said they would be different because instead of just moving boxes, the stores would enrich lives instead. So everything about the experience you have when you walk into an Apple store is intended to enrich your life and to create an emotional connection between you and the Apple brand. Principle 6, master the message. You can have the greatest idea in the world, but if you can't communicate your ideas, it doesn't matter. Steve Jobs was the world's greatest corporate storyteller. Instead of simply delivering a presentation like most people do, he informed. He educated, he inspired, he entertained, all in one presentation. I wrote an entire book on Steve Jobs and his communications techniques, but if there's one thing that I think you could do today to be more Steve Jobs-like, it's to do this. Think visually. There were very few words on a Steve Jobs slide. That's a philosophy called picture superiority. It simply means that people are more likely to remember information when it's presented as words and pictures instead of just words alone. You know, I think it's impossible to watch a Steve Jobs presentation without completely rethinking your current one. Finally, Principle 7, sell dreams, not products. You know, Steve Jobs captured our imagination because he really understood his customer. In 1997, when Apple was close to bankruptcy, Steve Jobs said he would reduce the number of products that Apple sold to satisfy the needs of their core customers. At the time, he said, "Some people think you've got to be crazy to buy a Mac, but in that craziness, we see genius. And those are the people we're making tools for." Your customers don't care about your product, but they do care about themselves, their hopes, their dreams, their ambitions. Steve Jobs taught us, if you help your customers reach their dreams, you'll win them over. There's one story that I think sums up Steve Jobs' life and career. An executive who had the job of reinventing the Disney store once called Steve Jobs and asked for advice. Steve's advice? Dream bigger. I think that's the best advice he would give us today. Dream bigger. See genius in your craziness. Believe in yourself, believe in your vision, and be constantly prepared to defend those ideas. Because it's those ideas that could potentially change the world.
Again, I apologize for not coming up with the name of the author of that last piece. I just spent the time it was playing on the internet looking around trying to find it, but I can't dig it up. So I apologize. I'll try to come up with it later. If anybody else comes up with it, email me the name and I'll put it out here. But it did come from Forbes magazine. Now, the next piece I've got is a interview that a British television magazine did with Steve Wozniak right after the death of Steve Jobs. And Wozniak, for those of you who may not know, was the co-founder of Apple, and he was friends with Steve Jobs. They worked together in the garage to create a lot of the original Apple stuff. After listening to the interview, it certainly seems like they had a little bit of a competitive friendship. Mr. Wozniak has a definite high opinion of his own intelligence and value to Apple, which I'm quite sure is a valid feeling, but a little odd to hear somebody talk about themselves that way. You'll see what I mean when you listen to the interview.
Earlier, I spoke to Steve Jobs' co-founder at Apple, Steve Wozniak. I started by asking him what his first memory of Steve Jobs was.
Oh, my first memory was I had designed a computer and was building it in a garage down the street with a friend. And he said, you have to meet this other guy. He went to our high school and his name is Steve Jobs. And he understands digital electronics. And he also plays pranks at the high school, which I was famous for. So Steve came over and we met on the sidewalk, as I remember. And we just started asking each other, what did you do? What pranks did you do? And I would tell which ones I did. And then what'd you do? You know, what have you done with electronics? And he built this and I've designed all these computers. And we just hit it off. And then we merged into other topics that young people are into.
Were you aware that you were with a genius when you were with him?
Well, I was such a genius in computer design that it just overshadowed anything he would do in the technical realm. He was very fast thinking. He had an idea. He wanted to go here. He wanted to go there. He wanted to go there. He was almost driven with a lot of anxiety and hypermotion. But he had great thoughts and he had great thinking. And when we first started Apple, he would often pose very good questions. Why isn't a company organized this way? Why doesn't a certain person do a certain job rather than another person do it? And he was almost always, you couldn't contradict him. He also had this drive to have a role at first, eventually it would become like power, control, but a role of just having input into every major department and development in the company.
What will he be remembered for more than any other single thing? A particular product, the whole genre of Apple's products, or simply human genius?
I think he's going to be remembered for the categories of products that he took the world towards, the quality of the products that came out of Apple and his other companies, and also that he was an incredible business leader that built a huge company by basically keeping moving in good, solid, well-managed directions, operational excellence. So he'll be remembered in so many different ways.
Was he an easy guy to work with?
For me, he always respected me. And even in later years, even if I didn't have a very good answer, he didn't ever treat me like, oh, I was dumb or I didn't know that answer. He was very respectful, very nice and polite to me. So I never hung around enough to see, you know, what some people call, you know, brash behavior or whatever.
Was he a control freak?
The impression I got was that he wanted very much to be in control of the quality of products so that they wouldn't slip from insanely great down to just plain great. And almost everybody who watched him from the outside and from the inside close to him agrees with that.
Steve Wozniak.
And I don't call it control freak. I mean, so he had to explain. Yeah, you have to tell people, you know, this is not good enough. You got to go back and do it again. Is that a control freak? I mean, you're the CEO. By definition, you are the control.
Steve Wozniak talking about the insanely great Steve Jobs.
Now, so that this entire show isn't a complete downer, although some of it is uplifting, I think, I've got a little clip I got from the Orange County Register, and this is about the retirement of Ray Sedejas, who has for 46 years run custodial and done an absolutely outstanding job keeping the park beautiful and clean. So here's a little clip about Mr. Sedejas.
It was the best decision I ever made. Always thought I was going to be a police officer. I was actually beginning to realize that my station in life, my goal or where I should really be going is staying with Disney and dealing with the happy side.
For 47 years, Ray Sedejas has been dealing with the happy side of keeping the Disneyland Resort clean.
In essence, this is basically what I do every morning, go out and take a look.
Now he's retiring and talked with us about his early days beginning in 1964 at Disneyland.
It was a different pace. It was, the family, Walt Disney was here. There was something unique about Walt in the sense that you could tell that he enjoyed being here. And obviously he picked those Mondays and Tuesdays when it was closed so that he could enjoy walking through his Magic Kingdom. Walt had a special interest in watching cast members actually work in taking care of the Magic Kingdom. He would watch us do our work. And it was a little disconcerting at first because you got Walt Disney watching and people would say, you know, your partner on a project there would be saying, you know, Walt is watching us. I just want to let you know. Don't turn around or anything like that. Don't make it so obvious.
Ray and his wife Josie, who retired earlier this year from the Disneyland Resort, plan to do some traveling. And Ray will no longer be walking throughout the park every day to make sure it is kept clean.
I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss that sensation of going and experiencing all that's happening out there.
Mark Eads reporting for OCRegister.com.
Well, I went out, as I had mentioned on the last Podketeer podcast, and I went to Mickey's Halloween party on October the 7th, which was this last Friday. Had a great time. Lots of candy. Although I noticed this year no more Godiva chocolate, which was a definite downer. Because I was looking forward to having some more Godiva. Because that's some good stuff. But there was good stuff there still. There was Nestle's Crunch Bars and Milky Ways and Twix and Kit Kats. Lots and lots of M&M's, plain and peanut. And stayed away from the carrots. You know, that might kill me. But it was fun. It was certainly more crowded, although last year we went on like a Wednesday or something, and I wanted to go on Friday this year and see what it was like going on a more crowded day. There were not very many people in costume. That was a thing that I found a little disappointing. Yeah, you would think when you buy a ticket to a Halloween party, you'd wear a costume. Well, my daughter and her boyfriend and I all had costumes on. I had Tweedledee on again this year. I get a lot of good comments about it. I had 6 people want to take their picture with me, and I broke the Disney rule and went ahead and took pictures with people, but they don't seem to care as long as you don't make a big deal out of it. I didn't sign the autographs, but nobody asked me for an autograph, just wanted their picture taken with me. But it was fun. A fireworks demonstration was about the same as it was last year. It maybe added just a little bit more to the projection on the big balloon. But most of that was the same as it was last year. The parade, such as it is, they don't even call it a parade now, they call it a cavalcade. Now, I don't know what the difference between a cavalcade and a parade is, because it was pretty much a parade. But the song leaves a little bit to be desired, and you know, it's kind of plain. I mean, it's all right. they had Mickey and Minnie in the same purple costumes they've worn about the last 4 or 5 years. I think it's time for Mickey and Minnie to go down to Halloween Club and pick them up some new costumes, because those are getting kind of old. But other than that, had a great time. And now I do have one little minor Disney gripe. I wrote a letter to Bob Iger today. Whether he'll actually get it or not, I don't know. But I have a problem with the fact that right before the fireworks shows now, they have a non-costumed cast member wearing coveralls walking around in plain sight on the castle, putting together the rigging of, I don't know if it's electronics or what it is up on top of the castle, getting ready for the fireworks show. Now, to me, that violates the way Walt Disney wanted things done. He didn't want anything to take away from the illusion that it was really a castle. And castles, I don't think back in the days that these are supposed, the fairy tale lands that these are supposed to come from, I don't believe they had men in coveralls walking around on them. So that definitely takes away from the show. And they have a little insider saying at Disneyland when something takes away from the value of the show, they say bad show. So, Disneyland, I'm afraid I have to say bad show when it comes to that. You need to stop having people walking around on the castle in plain view of the guests wearing coveralls. That's just not working for me. So, please pay attention and do something about that. Well, now, to wrap up the show, I've got the 2005 Steve Jobs commencement address at Stanford University. Now, this has been getting quite a bit of play, although almost all of them have just been playing the one segment of it where he speaks about his mortality. And that's definitely apropos right after his death. But he speaks about a lot of other things also that I think it's a good idea to get the whole speech out here, because it's much more uplifting than just listening to the part about his death. Because he lived a very valuable life that we will all benefit from for the rest of ours. So, Steve Jobs, thanks a lot for everything you've done. Thanks for all my iPods, and thanks for iTunes and iMovie, and thanks for making Bill Gates step up and do the things that he's done. Because I have to say, if you weren't out there prodding them, I think that the PCs would be a lot less than they are now. So I think Bill Gates owes you a thank you, too. So, Podketeers, I'm going to play this little bit for you, and then we're going to wrap up the show with the usual recorded exits. So, y'all have a magical Disney week, and enjoy this little bit of audio.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you today for your commencement from one of the finest universities in the world. Truth be told, I never graduated from college, and this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. Today, I want to tell you three stories from my life. That's it. No big deal. Just three stories. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference. My second story is about love and loss. I was lucky. I found what I loved to do early in life. Woz and I started Apple in my parents' garage when I was 20. We worked hard, and in 10 years, Apple had grown from just the two of us in a garage into a $2 billion company with over 4,000 employees. We just released our finest creation, the Macintosh, a year earlier, and I'd just turned 30. And then I got fired. How can you get fired from a company you started? Well, As Apple grew, we hired someone who I thought was very talented to run the company with me. And for the first year or so, things went well. But then our visions of the future began to diverge, and eventually we had a falling out. When we did, our board of directors sided with him. And so at 30, I was out, and very publicly out. What had been the focus of my entire adult life was gone, and it was devastating. I really didn't know what to do for a few months. I felt that I had let the previous generation of entrepreneurs down, that I had dropped the baton as it was being passed to me. I met with David Packard and Bob Noyce and tried to apologize for screwing up so badly. I was a very public failure, and I even thought about running away from the valley. But something slowly began to dawn on me. I still loved what I did. The turn of events at Apple had not changed that one bit. I'd been rejected, but I was still in love. And so I decided to start over. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again, less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. During the next 5 years, I started a company named Next, another company named Pixar, and fell in love with an amazing woman who would become my wife. Pixar went on to create the world's first computer animated feature film, Toy Story, and is now the most successful animation studio in the world. In a remarkable turn of events, Apple bought Next, and I returned to Apple, and the technology we developed at Next is at the heart of Apple's current renaissance. And Laureen and I have a wonderful family together. I'm pretty sure none of this would have happened if I hadn't been fired from Apple. It was awful tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life's going to hit you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life. And the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. And don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle. My third story is about death. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable, and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try and tell your kids everything you thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I live with that diagnosis all day. Later that evening, I had a biopsy where they stuck an endoscope down my throat, through my stomach, and into my intestines, put a needle into my pancreas and got a few cells from the tumor. I was sedated, but my wife, who was there, told me that when they viewed the cells under a microscope, the doctor started crying because it turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and thankfully, I'm fine now. This was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet, death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday, not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it's quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand, not far from here in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 60s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic, overflowing with neat tools and great notions. Stuart and his team put out several issues of the Whole Earth Catalog, and then, when it had run its course, they put out a final issue. It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age. On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off. Stay hungry, stay foolish. And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much.
Podcatcher is in no way associated with the Walt Disney Company or any of its affiliates. Mickey Mouse Copyright 1928, The Walt Disney Company. Any similarity to Disney characters or real persons without satirical purpose, the act of reviewing products, or reporting on newsworthy events, is entirely coincidental. This podcast is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. For more information, visit our website at www.podcatcher.com. The great caricature artwork on the Podcatcher website was created by Disneyland artist Catherine Clark. You may email her at portraitsandcaricatures@yahoo.com. Her blog is located at www.myspace.com/Clark_art.
I'd just like to take a moment to again thank my friend Rick Moyer at MoyerMultimedia.com for taking the time to put together the theme song to the Podcatcher podcast. If you need any voiceover work, or you need any kind of a theme song or music put together for a presentation or for your company, or for a podcast. You look Rick up. He could not be more helpful. His name is Rick Moyer, and the name of his website is MoyerMultimedia.com.
Podcatia, podcasting right on schedule, whenever we damned well feel like it.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Disneyland has now concluded its normal operating day.
Yeah, folks, and me and my pals hope you had a swell time.
Oh, yeah.
Mickey?
It's
that time.
What time is that, Minnie?
Oh, Goofy?
Huh? Oh.
Now it's time to say goodnight to all our company. M-I-C.
See you real soon.
It's always Mickey Mouse.
K-E-Y.
Why?
Because we like you.
M-O-U-S-E.
For your shopping convenience, this evening, Main Street will remain open for an additional half hour.